This week calls for a ceasefire in Gaza as Israel drops more bombs and a humanitarian catastrophe becomes more dire by the day.
The brutality perpetrated by Hamas can never justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people.
We'll hear from an Israeli father whose son is still being held hostage in Gaza.
I don't know if it's okay. I don't know if he has water, if he sleeps, if he eats.
And fears of a larger humanitarian crisis in Ukraine as Russia's war continues and U.S. military aid for Ukraine remains uncertain. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Israel ramped up strikes on the Gaza Strip Friday, pounding the length of the Palestinian enclave and killing hundreds in a new expanded phase of the war that Washington said veered from Israeli promises to do more to protect civilians. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Thursday made his strongest public criticism so far of Israel's conduct of the war.
It remains imperative that Israel put a premium on civilian protection. And there does remain a gap between exactly what I said when I was there. The intent to protect civilians and the actual results that we're seeing on the ground.
Meanwhile, the United States vetoed a United Nations resolution demanding an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. Friday's vote came after Secretary General Antonio Guterres for the first time invoked Article 99 of the UN Charter, which enables a UN chief to raise threats he sees to international peace and security as he warned of a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza.
We are all aware that Israel began its military operations in response to the brutal terror attacks unleashed by Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups on 7 October. I unreservedly condemn those attacks, and I'm appalled by the reports of sexual violence. There is no possible justification for deliberately killing some 1,200 people, including 33 children, injuring thousands more, and taking hundreds of hostages. At the same time, the brutality perpetrated by Hamas can never justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people.
U.S. Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood said halting military action would allow Hamas to continue ruling Gaza and only, quote, plant the seeds for the next war. Meanwhile, the number of casualties at Khan Yunis Hospital grows as Israel expands its operation in South Gaza. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The injured are carried on stretchers as speedily as possible inside Nasser Hospital, at least one young boy among the number. The return of the military operation marks a grim new chapter in the war that the Gaza Health Ministry says has killed over 17,000 Palestinians and displaced what the UN estimates to be 1.9 million people. The widening air and ground offensive has left Palestinians packed together in dire humanitarian conditions. I'm Charles Ledesma.
The World Health Organization reports the health system in Gaza is on its knees. While acknowledging Israel's right to defend itself, it says Israel's bombing campaign has rendered the lives of innocent Palestinian civilians unsustainable. And that is especially true for children. I spoke with Doctors Without Borders physician Tanya Haj Hassan about the dire medical situation on the ground.
Some of the last statistics we had heard were around 6,000 children killed and at least 2,000 others whose bodies were trapped under the rubble. And so, you know, you're looking at potentially around 8,000 children, and that's a figure that's outdated. And that excludes all the children who've been maimed for life as a consequence of their injuries, and all the children who have severe injuries and are in hospital, many of whom are dying as a consequence of the destruction of the healthcare system and inability to treat their infected wounds or their burns. So if you're just going to talk about the killing of children as a consequence of aerial bombardment and the injuries that the children have sustained as a consequence of aerial bombardment, we're talking around 8,000 children killed and then at least 10,000 others wounded and many maimed for life. Then there's all the children who are displaced and facing lack of access to clean water, safety, shelter, food, protection, education, all the fundamental rights of children. The majority or all of Gaza's pediatric population essentially has been stripped of those things. I'm sure you've heard of all the children who've lost their families and who are the only surviving members members of their family and who are being cared for. You know, I keep being asked, well, who's caring for these children? The fact is, we don't even know. The sad truth is we don't know what's happening to so many of the children who have been left without guardians.
The doctors that you're speaking to, how are they coping?
These are the most dedicated healthcare providers I have met in my career. They're the same people who refused to leave the hospitals when they were told to evacuate in the beginning, who stayed with their patients till the last minute, who moved south or stripped of their ability to care for patients under the conditions in which they were trained and are now looking for ways to continue helping. They are the most dedicated people and they see it as a sense of purpose. You may have seen the interview of Dr. Hamam Allo, and that he is a nephrologist who I knew as well, who was interviewed on Democracy Now some 3 weeks ago or so. He was asked why he had refused to evacuate south, and he said, and if I go, who treats my patients? We're not animals. We have the right to receive proper health care. You think I went to medical school and my postgraduate degree for a total of 14 years so I can think only about my life and not about my patients? This is not the reason I became a doctor. I knew Dr. Hamam Allo, and he was killed along with his father and his father-in-law. He has two young children. His wife and two young children survived. They were next door when this happened. And, you know, it's devastating. These are the people who are being killed, both not only in their homes, but also while they are working, while they are physically working in the hospital, like what we saw with the doctors from MSF that were killed at Al-Auda Hospital a couple of weeks ago. They're killed while they're providing care. They also feel, you know, stripped of the ability to care for their patients. And one of the doctors said that the suffering that we are seeing cannot be described or articulated. And another doctor said, as medical staff, we now feel helpless. There are hundreds of sick and injured people in front of our eyes and we can't do anything. And this was in reference to not having the resources to care for the patients that they're seeing.
And as you mentioned, they're risking their lives to save their patients, which is what their life's work is. But it sounds like they're also becoming victims.
Absolutely. I mean, there are at least 250 healthcare workers that have been killed in the Gaza Strip to date. Those are the names and faces that we know of. I'm sure there are many others that we don't know of yet, several of whom I knew personally. We've also heard reports of healthcare workers being abducted on this humanitarian corridor from north to south. I think so far there are a total of 11 whose families have reported that they disappeared on this humanitarian corridor traveling from north to south. There are some reports of a number of them being taken by Israeli forces. I believe so far there are 9 missing doctors, a missing paramedic, and a missing dentist. One of the physicians we knew, he was a student of ours and has young children. He had been working at the hospital, had evacuated with one of the convoys that were evacuating patients from hospitals in the north to the south. And what we had heard is that he had been taken, but we don't know where or why, and we haven't heard from him since. Those that we know of that were within that convoy were within an arranged convoy of doctors and paramedics and patients that were transporting the sick patients that they were trying to evacuate from the hospitals in the north.
Doctors Without Borders physician Tanya Haj Hassan. Thursday marked the beginning of Hanukkah, Judaism's holiday known as the Festival of Lights. This year's celebration comes amid a somber mood that is all-consuming in Israel, especially for families who still have loved ones being held hostage. I spoke with Shai Wenkert, whose 22-year-old son Omer is one of those hostages. He hasn't heard from his son since October 7th. Your 22-year-old son Omer was at the music festival and taken hostage, and he also suffers from a chronic medical condition. What can you tell us about that and what happened?
Omer was kidnapped by the Hamas from the music fest. It was at the shelter for about 1.5 hours until he went out. He just said that he don't want to die inside. There was a gun shooting and there were hand grenades thrown inside and burning inside the shelter. Something that the smoke went inside. And the last sentence that he sent us on the WhatsApp, it's, I'm frightened. And then he went out from the shelter. When he went out, the Hamas terrorists kidnapped him.
And it looks like you found out through a video of him in the back of some sort of vehicle.
We found out at noon, after a few hours, that we are trying to connect with him, trying to look for him at videos from the Facebook or on any media. And a friend called me and he told me that Omer is alive. I have a video, but he probably not in our hands. This was terrifying to see my son, that he was brutally beaten and kidnapped to the Gaza Strip. with the SUV of the Hamas. You can see him beating and piercing him. He's only with underwear, with handcuff, and we have also a photo that also published by the Telegram of the Hamas. It is only with underwear, his hands under his back, and he's lying on the sandbags. It's supposed to go to the Palestinian refugees, but the Hamas always probably took it for the wrong cause.
I'm sure that was very painful to see. Did it at least give you some relief that he was alive?
I don't know if I can say at the same moment on the 7th of October, yes, but I thought he's staying alone and I didn't know the real situation. It was horrible to think about it. I tried to call many, many people to reach out for any assistance that maybe they can do. And unfortunately, he was already in Gaza Strip, and to go inside, it's impossible for civilians. Yeah, I saw my son alive and I know he's alive. And 2 days later, an officer from the IDF came to us to inform us that he's captive by the Hamas, and that's it. And since then, we don't know nothing.
You've heard nothing about his condition or his whereabouts at all?
No, nothing at all, nothing.
And he does have some chronic health issues. I'm sure that that's also weighing on you.
Yeah, he has a colitis disease. It's a chronic disease. In a situation of stress and bad condition, it's getting severe. It's getting very painful in the stomach. It's getting diarrhea every couple of hours. He needs his medicine. He needs a medical aid. It's very difficult to think about it that he's not getting any medical aid. I don't know. I don't know if it's okay. I don't know if he has water, if he sleeps, if he eats, because we heard the evidence of released hostages that they describe it that worst case to be there. They need to take them out. They have to take them all out, and the sick people first, because they have no other day to stay there for them. I want them to do a massive efforts with all the countries that are speaking with. They need to take all hostages out.
I'm sure it's especially painful for those of you with family members like your son, Omer, who is a male, and women and children being released, although that seems to have come to a stall with the war now escalating.
Oh, from the evidence that we heard, I heard today, one of the hostages that released, she is a woman, and she was released with two of her children, but her husband was over there with her. Mm. And she described awful things that even the men can't stay there. It's horrible to be there. They're not surviving. I don't want to think my son will be back as a body.
What was she saying?
He described that he's in a very bad condition, that he is also wounded, and there is no medical aid, and he suffers a lot.
And she just described the situation as unsustainable.
Unsustainable, and no one can stay there.
Tell us about Omer. What do you want people to know about him?
Omer is 22 years old. He's my oldest son. I miss him a lot. Every day it's getting even difficult, more difficult. He's a very kind and very happy boy. He's only a boy, he's 22 years old. He likes music, he likes foodies, he likes restaurants, he's also a manager of a big restaurant. He wants to learn about the managing of a restaurant. This is the career that he wants to do. He has a lot of friends, all kind of friends. Everybody loves him. Everybody wants to be next to him. He's like a human magnet. He's very smiling, very handsome guy. Everybody loves him. Everybody loves him.
We're really hoping that you hear from him and see him and can hold him again very soon. And all of the families that are in agony, we're just hoping and praying that they can come back to their loved ones as soon as possible and be safe.
We are praying every day. We're hoping.
I'm so sorry for what you're going through. I'm sure it is just unimaginable, the pain and agony of not knowing, and we'll be thinking of you and praying for you and hoping for the best. And thank you for sharing his story.
Thank you very much, Lori.
Shai Wenker, whose son Omer is still being held by Hamas in Gaza. With the war raging on, it's hard to imagine what happens when it's all over. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
While we deal with the current crisis, we cannot lose sight of the only viable possibility for a peaceful future, a two-state solution on the basis of United Nations resolutions and international law, with Israel and Palestine living side by side in peace and security.
I spoke with Mara Rudman, senior counselor at the Center for American Progress, on the prospects of peace given the current state of affairs.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is promising war will continue until it eradicates Hamas. Doesn't sound like Israel is ready to talk about any sort of two-state solution. President Biden has also called for that.
I think that we, the United States, needs to be doing several things at once with all of the parties. We need to maximize Israel's ability to defeat Hamas, defeat their ability to control and lead in Gaza, and from that position, continue to work to eradicate Israel, which is Hamas's goal. We need to make sure that as many Palestinian civilians in Gaza as possible are spared from what is going on. We ultimately need to see Prime Minister Netanyahu and the ultra-right wing, frankly, with former terrorists in his coalition, we need to see them ultimately no longer in charge in Israel. We need to have all the hostages returned and Iran deterred, and that the Palestinian Authority, which currently is weak as it is in the West Bank, needs to be reinvigorated in a way that is supported by moderate Arab states in the region and is ultimately able to be in a position to lead a Palestinian state. I don't think that that is the case right now. So those are a lot of different things that the United States needs to do, and we need to do them concurrently. And so, yes, it's important that the UN has called for two states with a capital in Jerusalem. Frankly, there's nothing new in that. Important that President Biden has stated what has been his position for decades, and has been the position of every United States president except President Trump since President Clinton, that the ultimate resolution of this conflict, which is very much in the United States' interest, is only going to occur with a Palestinian state side by side with the state of Israel, both secure, stable, and ideally democratic. So that's where we are, and all of those things must be pursued concurrently and not sequentially.
Is it really possible, though, to completely eliminate Hamas? And is the only solution the way Israel has been going about it?
In terms of eliminating Hamas, those are not the words I used. I think what is possible and important is removing Hamas from the ability to control, and frankly, quite unfairly, control the people of Gaza and the governance of Gaza, and use that position to take military terrorist action against the state of Israel. That is different than eliminating. Yeah. And I would put it much more akin to what the United States pursued with respect to ISIS, right? ISIS no longer has a caliphate, no longer controls vast swaths of Iraq and Syria to commit its kind of heinous and barbaric crimes. But ISIS hasn't been eliminated entirely. It still exists in various pockets. The movement exists, horrendous as it is. But to be able to even get to the point that I described in terms of Hamas is a combination of military and diplomatic action. So on the military side, you've seen the United States come out increasingly publicly with what I believe they've been saying privately for some time, which is that it needs to be done much more surgically, and particularly because of the need to, for Israel at this point, to be able to act in southern Gaza as well, which is where the population has largely moved, of 2 million civilians, most of whom are entirely innocent and really trapped in this horrendous situation. So the United States has publicly talked about a much more surgical approach by Israel militarily. It's not talked about Israel not doing anything. It's talked about a surgical approach to the fullest extent possible. Also, be clear that the truce period allowed Hamas to regroup considerably and to regroup its efforts. And so all of that needs to be put into the calculation. At the same time that there needs to be thought to the immediate day after, how will Gaza be governed civilian in terms of civilian structures of governance, where the UN undoubtedly will be heavily involved as they have been for some time in Gaza, and how will security be controlled? And at the same time with that, how do you build toward ultimately West Bank and Gaza together for the Palestinians in a way that builds towards a Palestinian state? And you ultimately need different actors in place, certainly in Israel, for that to happen. I think it's likely that Israeli democracy will come together to lead to that result post-conflict. And Palestinians, in conjunction with Arab states in the region, need to figure out how to rebuild, revitalize the Palestinian Authority leadership.
And as far as the hostages go, as obviously one of the major elements in all of this is getting them all released, Hamas is claiming it doesn't have a number of them. What do you make of those claims?
I think it's quite likely to be accurate in terms of the number of different groups, cells, gangs, call it what you will, who went into Israel to commit the horrible barbarism that occurred. That was Hamas coordinated, Hamas led. It was not solely Hamas involved. And it was not even that it was just Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is another, believe it or not, even more extremist group than Hamas that exists in Gaza. I think it could be families, it could be gangs. There's a number of informal groups. And it's very clear that hostages were taken by virtually all of the different cells, elements that went into Israel. I don't think it is safe to presume that Hamas has insight and authority over all of the different bad actors that they coalesced to go in and commit the acts against Israel that occurred on October 7th.
I guess that complicates things dramatically.
It does, particularly when you think of the extraordinary tunnel structure that underlies underneath Gaza. And so being able to know, communicate, identify with a variety of different bad actors who are, you can be sure, all utilizing that tunnel structure.
Do you think that we'll get to a point where we at least have a resolution as to who is still alive and potential for actually finding these people?
I very much hope that we get to a resolution where every person who was taken is accounted for. I am not sure that that will be the case. I certainly hope that it will be. And I know that leaders of countries around the world, many of whom have hostages that were taken, are working toward that end.
Mara Rudman, senior counselor at the Center for American Progress. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. While the world's attention turns largely to Israel's war with Hamas, Russia continues to unleash death and destruction on Ukraine. But will the U.S. be able to continue supporting Kyiv's effort to drive Russian forces out of the country? The Biden administration is running out of time to secure a deal on tens of millions of dollars in wartime aid for Ukraine and Israel that Senate Republicans blocked Wednesday. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara reports.
Images released by the Ukrainian army shows the damage in the aftermath of a Russian attack in the southern city of Kherson this week, as U.S. funding for Kyiv's defense against Moscow's invasion is blocked by Senate Republicans, who are demanding tougher measures to secure the U.S. border with Mexico. Republican Senator Jim Risch speaking to VOA.
We Republicans are very serious about closing our southern border. We have about over 10,000 people a day, illegals crossing into the United States. We need to defend our border first and foremost.
The White House says Republicans have ignored its border and immigration reform proposal. President Joe Biden warned on Wednesday that if Kyiv loses its war, Russian President Vladimir Putin will move beyond Ukraine to attack a NATO member, and the U.S. will be obligated to defend it.
Then we'll have something that we don't seek and that we don't have today. American troops fighting Russian troops. American troops fighting Russian troops if he moves into other parts of NATO.
Biden has signaled he is willing to compromise, but he says time is running out. There is $4.8 billion remaining in aid for Ukraine, but only $1.1 billion left to replenish U.S. weapons and equipment stockpiles to supply Kyiv what it needs. Emma Ashford, senior fellow with the Reimagining U.S. Grand Strategy Program at the Stimson Center via Skype.
If U.S. aid doesn't come through, Europeans are likely to step into the breach to some extent. But at a minimum, the Ukrainians are going to have to turn to a more defensive war and potentially start to look for ways to actually end the conflict.
VOA asked National Security Council's John Kirby whether the administration would support ceasefire negotiations.
President Zelensky gets to determine how and when this war ends and under what conditions, and he's willing to negotiate with Mr. Putin.
To pass $60 billion in aid for Ukraine and $10 billion for Israel, Congress has limited time before the end-of-year break. European partners are nervous. Britain will continue supporting Kyiv, Foreign Secretary David Cameron told VOA on Thursday.
But clearly, America is an essential partner in this. They are the world's biggest economy, the biggest defense player. Absolutely vital.
Complicating matters, January 19th is also the first deadline to fund part of the government to prevent a shutdown. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.